Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, October 28th, a Tuesday. And we're going to finish up sensory chapter today, move into endocrinology. But before we get started, do we have any announcements from SI? Oh, we do. Right on. Go for it.
No special announcements, but regular sessions Tuesdays and Thursdays in the morning. You guys have a test coming up, so don't forget to come and prepare an event.
Excellent, excellent suggestion. Okay, let's take a look at the schedule. Somebody mentioned a test coming up. Is that true? Is that possible? Let's see. All right, so we're done with exam number two. Today's the 28th, so that was a week ago. So what is the next test? The next test is on a Thursday, all right, and today's a Tuesday. So it's two and a half weeks away. So I guess that is coming pretty soon thereafter, and the chapters will be 10, 11, 12, and 13, and yeah, hopefully we get that all done. Okay, so anybody have a question on the schedule? You're okay with the schedule, good. Okay, so let's take a look at what slides we have left. Last time we talked about pupil constriction or dilation, and that is due just to the amount of ambient light. So when you're in dim light conditions, your pupil dilates, which lets more light into your eye for you to perceive things. And when it's very bright, then the iris constricts, like in this case down over here, that protects the retina from too much energy. So there are two kinds of muscles. There's circular muscles, radial muscles. And when the circular muscles contract, that causes constriction of the pupil, and that is the result of the parasympathetic nervous system. And when we need to dilate our eyes, then the circular muscles relax and the radial muscles then contract, right, and that dilates the pupil, and that's underneath the, or that's under the control of the sympathetic nervous system, right, so antagonistic effects. And, of course, that makes sense because when you're in a fight-or-flight circumstance, right, your pupils do dilate so that you can just have better acuity of the things that are happening around you. So that makes perfect sense. So always relate parasympathetic and sympathetic to that fight-or-flight or rest-and-digest way of thinking about things. That's really powerful. Okay, so next slide, accommodation. Accommodation is a process whereby you can focus on an object, and the focus has to change. Your focus has to change when an object is close to you or when it's far away from you. The lens situation or how light is focused on the retina is different because the light rays reach your eye in a different manner. So for instance, let's do an experiment. Let's take one of your hands, put it as far out in front of you as you can, and then stare at your fingertips so that your fingertips are nice and in focus. You see your fingertips? Anybody not see their fingertips? You see your fingertips? Okay, yeah, you can take your glasses off or leave them on. All right, now the important thing is not your fingertips. I want you to then just consider the background. Don't look at the background. Look at your fingertips. But what does the background look like? It's blurry. It has all the same colors, but it's blurry. All right, and so now look at the background. Concentrate on the background and don't concentrate on your fingertips. Now what can you tell me about your fingertips? Now they're blurry. Background is in focus and fingertips are blurry. So you can only focus at one distance at a time. So you can focus close up, which means then the far vision will be blurry, or you can focus far away, and that means that the near vision will be blurry. You can't have both at the same time. That's just the law of physics. So what allows you to do that is a process called accommodation. And accommodation is due to changing the shape of the lens, and the muscle that changes the shape of the lens is called the ciliary muscle or ciliary body. I think you remember that from anatomy. And then there are some suspensory ligaments that attach the circular, it's a circular smooth muscle which is attached to the lens via these suspensory ligaments. So we need to look and see how that works. It's kind of strange because usually you think when a muscle contracts, that's when it puts tension on something, right? So when my biceps contracts, it puts tension on my forearm, right, and it flexes my forearm. Well, a little bit different circumstance happens with the ciliary muscle. And that's because it's a circular smooth muscle. When the when a circular smooth muscle contracts, then the diameter decreases, right? It shrinks down. And when the diameter decreases, that releases tension on the suspensory ligament. And when that happens, then the lens goes back to its normal shape, which is kind of thick, right? It just goes back to a thick condition. And when the ciliary muscle relaxes, like this condition right here, right? When it relaxes, the circular muscle gets bigger, the diameter gets bigger, and as it gets bigger, it puts more tension on the suspensory ligaments. So in this particular circumstance, when the muscle relaxes, that's when it puts most tension on the insertion or the lens. And when we put a nice circular tension around the lens, it pulls it wider, but also thinner, so it changes the curvature of the lens. So can you tell me which lens has more curvature, the one on the bottom or the one on the top? Which one has more curvature? One on the bottom, right? That is when the ciliary muscle is contracted, thereby reducing the tension in the suspensory ligaments, and this lens has elastic property, and it becomes more curved. And when it becomes more curved, then you can see things closer to your eyes. And when you're looking at things far away, then that muscle relaxes, right, and puts some tension on these suspensory ligaments. All right, so that is a process called accommodation. And just remember accommodation, what that is all about. So just think maybe of your fingertips. All right, visual acuity. So this is how we focus light on our eyes. So here we have the anterior part of the eye. Here's the posterior part. And this posterior part has the retina. These are where the photoreceptors are. And in order for you to see a sharp object, light coming from the object, which is way out here someplace, has to be focused to a certain point. So if you're looking at the eraser on a pencil, right, all of that light should focus right here. It shouldn't be spread out over the whole retina because then it's going to look blurry. It should only reach one point. So in this particular condition, the shape of the lens and the shape of the cornea are just so that when light enters the eye, it focuses exactly on the retina. And so we call this emmetopia, and under this condition, you don't need any corrective lenses because you see things nice and sharp no matter what, no corrective lens. Okay. But sometimes the shape of our eyeball changes, or maybe it's just not put together exactly the right way. Right? In this particular case, and this is what we call myopia, the eyeball is too long. Right? We didn't change the shape of the lens or the cornea, so the light is still going to focus at the exact same point. But where is that point? Where is that point? It is in front of the retina, so that's the focus point. And so then that point light starts to diverge once again by the time it reaches the retina, and therefore it's going to produce a blurry image. So the kind of corrective lens that's needed, right, because we don't really want to change the shape of the eyeball and or the lens, right, we can put what we call a concave lens in front of the eye that spreads the light beams out a little bit by the time it reaches the cornea and the lens, and now the light will focus exactly on the retina. All right, so this concave spreads the light out so that the over-focusing in myopia, right, is corrected so you have a nice sharp image on the retina. All right, and that's what we call nearsightedness, when light focuses in front of the retina. Well, some of us might have an eyeball that's too short compared to a normal condition. And if it's too short, and we're going to keep the lens and the cornea the same shape, then light is going to focus behind the retina. And as you can see, as the light passes through the retina, it is still diverging. It's not focused at a point. And so once again, the image is going to be blurred looking. And one easy way to correct this is with a lens placed in front of the eye, right? And in this particular case, we want a lens that will help focus, right? Not defocus like in the myopic condition, but something that will focus, and then the light will be focused on the retina. So this convex lens starts to shape the light, starts to bend the light, and then when it reaches the cornea and the lens, then it's nice and focused right on the retina. So we got these two different kinds of lenses, right? Concave, convex. depending on how light is bending. All right, so what do I want to show you? I have a nice slide to show you something. Let me go to this right here, and this right here. So here we have just a point, and this point is going to be emitting light. Here is that same point, emitting the same light, right? But in the first condition, this object is very far away from the eye. Second condition, it's a lot closer. So what I want you to appreciate is what happens to light by the time it reaches the eye when it's far away compared to when it's really near. So if light is really far away, by the time that light reaches the eye, these light beams are almost parallel to each other. They're almost parallel. They're not diverging. They're diverging a little bit, but not very much. So since these are parallel light beams, right, it's relatively easy to focus an object on the retina. But when an object gets really close to your eye, can you see that now these lines, as they enter your cornea and through the pupil, they are still diverging. So that means that they're still going to diverge by the time they get back to the lens, I mean back to the retina. So therefore, since they're still diverging, the lens that you have has to have more curvature to correct for the more divergent light beams as the object comes closer and closer to you. All right, so you just kind of have to believe me that these light rays from a distant object are more parallel. Light rays from a close object are still diverting, right? They're still spreading out. And under those conditions, then you need more focusing power from a lens to get it to focus at the exact same spot. This is the best slide I could come up with to show you that far objects have light rays that are mostly parallel. Close objects have light rays that are still mostly spreading apart, and you need more focusing power from the lens in order to get it focused on the retina. Okay. And of course, your lens can change shape. How does your lens change shape? Can anybody tell me how does your lens change shape? What causes that? Yeah, it's a muscle, and in particular, the ciliary muscle, and I see it here and here. And how did that work? When the ciliary muscle contracts, then the diameter gets smaller. That reduces tension on the suspensory ligaments, and then the elastic property of the lens makes it get really thick. Okay, and so that would happen during when an object is really close to you. Right, so that's when the ciliary muscle is relaxed. When an object is really far away, then we need to put some tension on the lens to flatten it out. So how do we put tension on these suspensory ligaments? This is the strange part. Not by contracting the muscle, but by relaxing that circular muscle, then the diameter gets bigger, and as it gets bigger, it puts more tension on these suspensory ligaments. All right, so that is, and what do we call this process of adjusting your focus as objects get farther from you or closer to you? That is called accommodation, right? Okay, so don't forget about that one. Sometimes we have a lens that's not perfectly curved on the top and the bottom. It's a little bit asymmetric, or maybe the cornea doesn't have the same curvature all the way around. And then the light, depending on where it enters the eye, will be converged or diverged at a different distance. So that maybe it's focused perfectly when light enters the top of the lens, but it won't be focused when light hits the bottom of the lens. So part of your image will be in focus, right, but not the whole image. I think in lab you look at a chart with numbers on it, and somebody with an astigmatism that's not corrected, right, they might be able to maneuver their eye so they can see the bottom row in perfect clarity, which is the hardest one, but up on the top, that will be all blurred. But for somebody that doesn't have an astigmatism, if they focus one row, what happens to all the rows? Then they're automatically in focus. But with astigmatism, one part will be in focus, but not another part. So there has to be a special uneven corrective lens, right, to take care of that asymmetry in either the lens or the cornea, which we call astigmatism. You see what this next slide looks like. Oh, wrong one. Let's go back to just looking at one. Click here. Okay, well, I want to say something else a little bit, which is pretty interesting. So here we see a lens, right? And it has a certain amount of curvature, and as light passes through it, it's going to bend light one way or the other. And there is something else in your eye that has curvature that light has to pass through. Does anybody see anything else in the eye that has curvature that light actually has to pass through to get to your retina? What else has some curvature to it? And because it has curvature, it's acting like a lens. It's helped focusing light. And that is, oh yeah, look at this cornea right here. All right, I didn't go over anatomy of the eye. That's okay, because you know it. So here is the cornea. It has a particular curvature, and that curvature is actually the most important thing for you to focus light on the retina. The only thing is, you can't use that for accommodation because it just has a fixed curvature. It can't change, right? But if you have, say, myopia, and you have way too much curvature on the cornea to focus light way back here on the retina, then there's a special procedure that can change the curvature on the cornea using a laser. Does anybody know what that's called? That's called a LASIK procedure, right? And so with the laser, then some of the cells are burned off in just less than a second, and then the cornea has the right shape so that now light focuses on the retina. So that's pretty cool. Right? But I don't think I would recommend that for cosmetic purposes because there are mistakes that happen, right? And it's an irreversible, basically it's an irreversible procedure once it's done. But for instance, if your vision is so poor to where you can't even find your glasses in the morning, right? Then that kind of procedure is great, right? It will just change your life. You won't need glasses. But there is something that's strange. Remember we said that you can't focus close up and far away at the same time. You have to pick one distance or another. After a LASIK procedure, it gives you perfect vision for far away, but now what happens to your near vision? It's worse. It gets sacrificed, right? So that's an unfortunate circumstance, and that's just a law of physics. So I've known a lot of people that really weren't aware of that, had a LASIK procedure, walked outside, looked around, world was in perfect clarity. They were just really, really happy because they could see things really clearly. Then they got a phone call, got their phone out of the pocket, looked at their phone, and guess what? They couldn't see the buttons on their phone anymore. So now they need reading glasses, right? So there's always a trade-off. But then once again, like I said, if your vision is so poor you can't even find your glasses in the morning, then that's great, right, that LASIK procedure. Or if you're an athlete and you can't afford to wear glasses because of head trauma or eye trauma, then of course that is important too. All right, so we said that light has to focus on the retina in order to see things sharply. So there are light receptors, there are photoreceptor cells on the retina or inside the retina. So here is a nice illustration of a retina. So light is coming in through the pupil, right? And it goes through like the vitreous humor in that posterior segment of the eye, and then it runs into the retina. But it has to pass through a couple layers of neurons to get to the photoreceptor cells. So in terms of light, the photoreceptor cells are deep inside the retina. They're not right on the surface. So a lot of students find that strange, and I suppose that is strange. Okay. So here are the photoreceptor cells, and they have a little shape to them. Here is one that we call a cone cell because it's conical, the tip is conical. Here is a rod cell, and it doesn't have a pointy end to it. So you have two different kinds of cells. And it just so happens that the cone cell is a lot smaller than the rod cell. That's not illustrated very well on this diagram. Right, so the cone cell is a lot smaller. The cone cell is also responsible for giving you color vision. Right, so cone cells can give you color vision. Rod cells cannot. But because the rod cells are bigger, not shown on this illustration, they can accumulate light from a bigger area, and therefore they're a lot more sensitive to light. So in dim light conditions, the rod cells will work for you, but the trade-off there is that rod cells only produce a black and white or grayscale image. Right? But these cone cells give you, because they're small, they receive light from a very small area. They give you high resolution, a very clear image that includes color. Right? The trade-off there is because they're so small, they require a lot of light in order to work. So where you have cone cells is right on the posterior pole of the eye, and where you have rod cells, as you move to your peripheral vision, right, the cone cells give way, and then there's greater and greater populations of cone cells in your peripheral vision. So that's the big difference between these rods and cones. So let's look at this diagram a little bit more. We see that there's three layers of the eye, right? We've got sclera, we've got choroid, right? And then we have the retina. The retina has been enlarged so that we can see the pieces of it. Notice that what you have in the choroid here, what do you see in the choroid layer? They're not labeled, but these are blood vessels. Okay, blood. I know the drawing is not the scale. If you said cells, that would be really good. But I think that's supposed to represent blood vessels. And what do you not see in the retina? I don't see any blood vessels. And that's a really good thing, because if there was a big blood vessel right here, that would push the rods and cones out of the way, and you would have a blind spot in that particular location. So you shouldn't have blood vessels in the retina. They should be in the choroid, and that's close enough to these cells to where diffusion will bring them oxygen and nutrients, right, and absorb CO2 to get rid of waste products. All right, so we've got sclera, which is tough, choroid, which is the vascular supply to the retina, and then the retina. Let's look at some of the layers of the retina. The pigmented epithelium right here has some melanin-producing cells, right? So it absorbs light. So when light comes in, it gets absorbed by this pigmented epithelium and doesn't bounce around inside your eye, because if it bounced around inside your eye, then you'd see flashes or other kinds of images that weren't related to reality, right? So this pigmented epithelium is important in that respect. The other thing is that these rods and cones are rebuilding themselves all the time. This is what we call the outer segment, this conical or this rod-shaped segment, and the tip is always being replaced, right, by deeper layers inside the cell. So these tip layers are removed, and when they're removed, it's the job of the pigmented epithelium right here to recycle those components so that they don't build up inside the retina. So that's a really important job. Because if those components built up inside the retina, then you would lose vision. And we also think that this pigmented epithelium is also important for immune response. It protects all of these cells of the retina from a person's own autoimmune response, and that protects the retina under most circumstances. All right, so the deep layer, the photoreceptor cells, then we see a network of different kinds of neurons. Ooh, what kind of neuron is this by shape? Is that a multipolar? Unipolar? It's a bipolar cell, right? And that's exactly where we said we would find bipolar cells, and that is in special senses. We saw it for olfaction. Here we see it for vision. All right, and then they synapse on these ganglion cells. Ganglion cells also get information from amacrine. So there is a lot of signal processing of an image, right, visual information that is entering your eye before it even gets to the brain. We're going to talk a little bit more about these bipolar cells in just a second. The ganglion cells, right, are just multipolar neurons. I see a few dendrites right here, and there's one long axon. Right, and this long axon from these ganglion cells form the optic nerve, and then what happens to that optic nerve? Crosses over at the optic chiasma, right, and then these same axons then become the optic tract, bringing photo information, light information, into your central nervous system. All right, so there's a lot of signal processing taking place, right, with these bipolar cells and amacrine cells and how they affect the ganglion cells. So all of these synapses right here are chemical synapses. So what does that mean? What do these cells secrete? Yeah, chemicals, and since they're neurons, they secrete neurotransmitters, right? So all of these cells secrete neurotransmitters that can inhibit or excite these various cells. All right, now I've talked about these already. Okay. Oh, here's a better illustration of what a rod cell looks like and a cone cell. So you can see that the outer segment of a rod cell is a lot bigger, it's a lot thicker, So when there's very little light, right, it still can, because it has a large surface area, it still can be activated, but the cone cell is really tiny. It needs bright light in order to operate. So the inner segment is pretty much like a neuron. It has cytoplasm and a nucleus, and it can produce a neurotransmitter. This outer segment right here has discs which have compounds in them that can absorb light. So in order for you to see light, there have to be pigments. And who can remember what a pigment is? What's a pigment? A pigment is some kind of chemical that can absorb light. And most chemicals can't absorb the full light spectrum, but maybe absorb one color more than another. And so do these chairs that we have in front of us, or that you're sitting on, do they have a pigment in them? Do they have a pigment? Yes, because why? They have color, right? And so there is, I don't know what color it is, but it's orange or green or yellow or something, right? What color is it? It's brown? I heard brown. No, not brown. What color is it? Nobody knows. I'm not the only one that's colorblind. Yellow? Okay, let's say it's yellow. All right, so it's a yellow pigment, but here's something interesting about a pigment. The pigment is something that will not absorb the yellow frequency, right? When light hits it, white light, which has all the colors of the rainbow, right? When white light hits it, that yellow pigment will absorb all colors except for yellow, and it will reflect yellow back, right, into your eye. So it will look yellow. So it's the color that is not absorbed. All right. And so there are different kinds of cone cells that absorb different kinds of light energy so that you can perceive different kinds of colors. Right, and then this is just a slide talking about this pigmented epithelium, which we talked about already. All right, so there is a compound. Let's just talk about a rod cell in particular. There is a compound called rhodopsin. So there's a big protein called opsin, and it has a space on the surface where another molecule can bind to it, and it is retinol. And so when we combine these things, right, this is what we call rhodopsin. And when they dissociate, you get an opsin molecule and a retinol molecule. And how is it that this retinol molecule can bind itself to the opsin molecule? What allows this binding to take place? It's shown on this slide. It's by the shape, right? So the retinol, in this particular case, the cis retinol has the right shape. It has a little bit of a bend in it to fit in the opsin molecule exactly. So if this opsin were an enzyme, what would we call this space on the surface where retinol can bind to it? That would be the active site, right? Okay. So that is the active site. And you know something about active sites, and that is what? Saturation and what else? Saturation, there are three things, but there's one thing that's really important. What's another term that you should think about when you think of an active site? Whether it's for a receptor or for an enzyme, it doesn't matter. They both can be saturated, but starts with an S. Substrate, retinol would be like a substrate for this particular system right here. But S, then P is the next. Specificity. What does specificity mean? Yeah, so that the active site has to have a complementary shape, almost an exact complementary shape compared to the ligand that's going to bind to it, right? So that's what we call specificity. So this system right here has to, or exhibits that exact same circumstance. So if we change the shape of retinol just a little bit, then guess what? Like in this case right over here, it doesn't fit in the active site, and then it's going to be released from the opsin molecule. So rhodopsin will dissociate into opsin and retinol. Why is that? Well, here is the retinol, and in this particular case, I see some CH3 groups, right? There's two on the top, and then there's one on the bottom, right? But the molecule in condition B, where are these methyl groups at? They're all on the top. So if we were to look at the chemical formula, these molecules would be exactly equal to each other, right? The only thing is that this one chemical bond has been twisted around so that this methyl group is sticking up instead of sticking down. And when that happens, it changes the whole shape of the molecule. It's not a drastic change in shape, right? I think it's a pretty small change in shape. It's still the same molecule, just a different isomer. And that different isomer can't fit into the opsin molecule, right, as a result of absorbing some light energy. And when that happens, that changes the permeability in that photoreceptor cell. And what happens to a cell when a permeability of the cell membrane changes to an ion, whether it's potassium or sodium, what happens? Then the electrical property of that cell changes, right? It can depolarize or hyperpolarize, but it won't be just that resting membrane potential if you change the permeability of the membrane to an electrolyte, right? It could either hyperpolarize or depolarize. All right, there's a lot of words on this slide. You're going to have to read through these because I could read them right now, but it won't make sense until after we look at a picture and describe what's happening in a picture. But what is interesting here, right? Ganglion cells, amacrine cells produce action potentials. This is true. You know a lot about action potentials. The rod and cone cells and bipolar cells and even these horizontal cells don't produce action potentials. They just produce graded potentials, right? So graded potentials can change amplitude. They can summate, all that kind of stuff, but not action potentials, of course. So where does a ganglion cell send action potentials? Into the brain, right? So that's the language of the brain. So that's a ganglion cell sends action potentials in there. Now the interesting thing is that this visual transduction, remember transduction is changing energy from one form to another, and what's being transduced here is what? Light energy into chemical energy or electrical energy inside these nerve cells is pretty much the inverse of other sensory systems that we're familiar with. So if you want to excite a cell, what is one way that you can excite a cell? I'll give you a hint. You change the permeability of the cell membrane to a particular ion. So if you want to excite a cell, what would you pick? What would you pick? Sodium. And what would happen to sodium? Sodium channel. You open a sodium channel, right? Sodium is high outside the cell, rushes inside. Sodium rushes inside the cell. What happens to the membrane potential of the cell? It depolarizes, becomes more positive, right? And that depolarization is excitatory. All right, now in the eye, at least for these rod cells, the opposite is true, right? The stimulus, which is light, is going to cause hyperpolarization. Right? It's not an excitatory. Light on the retina is actually an inhibitory system. And that's why we say it's an inverse transduction scheme. All right, so let's look at how this happens. I'll need a couple slides. All right, so here is a disc, and this is in a rod cell. These are all stacked together. So this is the rhodopsin molecule, and here is the retinol. This is the cis-retinol. It can bind to the opsin. There are also G proteins involved or associated with the rhodopsin. And what do you know about a G protein? What can a G protein do? It can dissociate and then do what? It can open up an ion channel, maybe it can turn an enzyme on or off, all kinds of nifty things. All right, so here is a cell that's in the dark, right? So the dark is what we want to consider stimulus or no stimulus. Dark is no stimulus, right? No stimulus. Let's look and see what's happening with this particular cell with no stimulus. Here is a sodium channel. And what can you tell me about the sodium channel in the dark? It is open. All right? Can you see that this sodium channel is open? So what's happening to the cell in the dark? It is depolarizing, which is excitatory. So in the dark, in the absence of stimulus, that's when this rod cell, okay, is depolarized or excited, which is kind of strange, right? So this sodium channel is open because it has a binding site for a molecule called cyclic GMP. Cyclic GMP is very similar to cyclic AMP, except it's a guanosine here instead of an adenosine. And it has the right shape to fit onto this ligand-gated channel. And the interesting thing, the ligand is what? Intracellular. It's not extracellular in this particular case. And when cyclic GMP is bound, the sodium channel is open, and then sodium enters the cell, causing depolarization, and that entry of this electrolyte is called the dark current. Right? Because when is it happening? In the dark. So this cell is depolarizing in the dark. Okay, so let's get back to this G protein once again. All right, it's stable in the dark, associated with the rhodopsin, and also inside the cell, there is a phosphodiesterase. Who can tell me what a phosphodiesterase does? Maybe I've mentioned this before, but I definitely want you to know what it is. Phosphodiesterase does what? Yeah, phosphodiesterase can break down cyclic AMP into just regular old AMP, a linear AMP, and guess what happens to the shape then of that AMP? Well, it changes drastically, right, from a cyclic form to a linear form. And when you change the shape of that molecule, what do you change?
Function.
Well, the function of it, right? Okay, so phosphodiesterase not only can break down cyclic AMP, but it can break down cyclic GMP. And in the dark, this phosphodiesterase is inactive, so what happens to cyclic GMP if phosphodiesterase is inactive? Well, it just sticks around, right? It doesn't go anywhere. It stays inside the cytoplasm, can bind to the sodium channel, keeping it open. So, and that causes what? Excitation of this rod cell. All right, and that's in the dark. Well, we need to shine some light on this, and what's going to happen? Well, this retinol molecule is going to absorb light. It's going to go through a conformation change, right? Turn the light on. Now it's going to go through the all-trans configuration, and what can you tell me about the shape of this retinol now? Can it still bind to the opsin molecule? It cannot, right? And when that happens, that activates the G protein, and that alpha subunit then kind of wanders around everywhere inside the cytoplasm. When it bumps into a phosphodiesterase, it will activate the phosphodiesterase. And what's the job of a phosphodiesterase once again? Breaks down a cyclic ATP or GMP into just regular old. And then when you don't have any cyclic GMP any longer inside the cell, what happens to the sodium channel? Yeah, it no longer has a ligand bound to it, so now it closes. And what happens to the cell in the light? What happens when you close a sodium channel in terms of the electrical properties? Is that excitatory or inhibitory? That inhibits the cell. Yeah, that helps repolarize or hyperpolarize the cell. So this cell, which was the rod, is inhibited in light conditions. So this is pretty strange. Because usually we think of a stimulus producing, what, depolarization and excitation of a cell, but not so for the retina. Let's take a look. Here is an exam figure. Let's take a look at what's happening here. So we've got two circumstances, right? We've got a dark condition and a light condition, and so we got condition 1 and 2. Which one has stimulus? 1 or 2? Which one has stimulus? I like 2 in the light, right? So I consider light the stimulus, right? And what's the strange thing about this system? In stimulus, what happens to the rod cell? It hyperpolarizes, right? It moves farther away from threshold. Let's see how that can happen. All right, so let's go back to in the dark. All right, in the dark we said that cyclic GMP is high because phosphodiesterase is inactive. Cyclic GMP binds to the sodium channel. It's a ligand-gated sodium channel. Opens it up, and that produces that dark current which keeps the cell depolarized or excited. Okay? And there is also a potassium channel here that's always open. There are a few of them that are always open. Okay, but not very many of them. Most of this cell right here has these ligand-gated sodium channels. And so as potassium leaks out and sodium rushes into the cell, of course you have that sodium-potassium pump, right? 3 and 2. What else does the sodium-potassium pump need? What does it need in order to work? Pump, 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 pump. When I say pump, it needs energy, right? Because it's doing work. It's doing work, right? In order to do work, you need energy. And that's in the form of ATP, right? So there, actually, you could draw on your slide ATP right here. The sodium-potassium pump is primary active transport, right? And so in order for your retina to work, what does it need? a lot of ATP because these sodium potassium pumps are working all the time, whether it's in the dark or the light. They're using up ATP, and retinas are highly metabolic, like brain tissue, like heart tissue. Okay. All right, so as sodium enters the cell, what happens to the rod cell here? As sodium enters, predominantly sodium. The effect is not predominantly potassium leaving, but mostly sodium entering because of this dark current that depolarizes the cell. It excites the cell to release neurotransmitter. Do you see neurotransmitter being released by the rod cell? Indeed, right? And then that, then here is a bipolar cell that has receptors for this neurotransmitter. And here is where the situation becomes a little bit more clear. Remember, neurotransmitters can either produce EPSPs or IPSPs. And in this particular case, in the dark, this is an inhibitory neurotransmitter that produces what kind of potential in this bipolar? It produces an IPSP. So in the dark, the bipolar cell is inhibited even though the rod cell is excited. And so that is pretty interesting and strange, right? But that's how come. Now, if we look at the other, and then since the bipolar cell is inhibited, it doesn't secrete neurotransmitter. And then the ganglion cell, which sends action potentials to the brain, is not excited. So in the dark, are there action potentials going to the brain? No, because the bipolar cell is not secreting neurotransmitter, because the rod cells are secreting inhibitory neurotransmitter in the absence of stimulus. So that's pretty fascinating how this works. Let's look at the light conditions. Well, what happens in the light? Who could tell me? Something happens. Okay, how does that sodium channel close? There's an enzyme that becomes activated. All right, light is absorbed by rhodopsin, right? And that then activates a G protein. And then the alpha subunit bumps into a phosphodiesterase, which activates the phosphodiesterase, which chews up cyclic GMP. When cyclic GMP concentration decreases, that sodium channel closes. And when that closes, what happens to the cell? Is it excited or is it inhibited? It is inhibited, right, in the condition of light or stimulus. So now the cell is inhibited. And when the rod cell is inhibited, it doesn't release neurotransmitter. But remember, that's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So the bipolar cell, because it's not inhibited, becomes excited because there are leaking channels in there all the time, like sodium channels. So now the bipolar cell secretes excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, and the ganglion cell will send action potentials to the brain under what conditions? Light conditions. So in the dark, the ganglion cell does not send action potentials, but in the light, ganglion cells do send action potentials to the brain. It's just that there's just kind of a funny circumstance, right, in this rod cell, because in the dark, the rod cell is excited. In the light, the rod cell is inhibited, but it works perfectly because the neurotransmitter released by the rod cell is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Okay. So this is an interesting scheme. And of course, these cells require a lot of ATP right away. They need ATP all the time, probably more so than most cells in your body. Yes. Okay, say this again. In what condition, light or dark? In dark. Dark situation like here, okay. There's no graded potentials being produced by neurotransmitter from the bipolar cell, right? So there's no action potentials going to the brain in the dark. You can't see anything in the dark. If it's perfectly dark, you can't see anything because you don't have action potentials going to the occipital lobe. No, not if it's really dark. You can see maybe a little bit if there's a little bit of light. There's a little bit of light, your iris dilates and lets as much light in as possible, but you still can't see very well. There still has to be some light. There has to be something that comes like from behind you, bumps into an object, and then is reflected back to your eyes. If there's nothing, no energy being reflected back to your eyes, then you can't see anything. If it's perfectly dark, you can't see anything. Yeah. Okay. So that's it for sensory chapter. Anybody have any other questions? So you're going to have to go find a really completely dark place and see if you can see anything. Maybe a closet or something. And tape all the holes closed. Turn all the lights off in your house. See if you can see anything. And I guarantee you cannot. Okay, that's not a hypothesis. That is what? That's theory. Yeah. So you need some kind of stimulus to inhibit that rod cell in order to get action potentials going to the brain. That's pretty much all there is to that. Okay. All right, so we'll put this away, and we're going to move on to next chapter, which is endocrinology. Well, we looked at the nervous system, and let's contrast the jobs of the endocrine system and the nervous system. What is the job that the nervous system does? It receives information and sends it. And where does it send it? Close or far away? It could be far away, right? And how does that information get to this faraway place? Does it take a long time? Like a day, a week, couple of weeks, or what? No, it's like very fast, right? Hundreds of miles an hour if it's a myelinated axon, right? So nervous system can send information for coordination fast over long distances, right? And remember, there's a way to activate a neurotransmitter in the synapse very quickly. So what's the duration of action of the nervous system? Once a neuron is sending an action potential, the duration is very short, okay? The duration is very short. So if we turn the light on and off over here, right, you're going to see the light come on right away, and then when we turn it off, do you still see the light on when I turn the light off? No, you don't see it goes away because the duration of action of the nervous system is very short. Okay, so that's nervous system. What about the endocrine system? Okay, endocrine system is for controlling various parts, coordinating various parts of your body, right? But it takes a little while to have an effect because a hormone, which comes from an endocrine gland, has to be secreted into the blood. The blood has to carry it everywhere in the body. Then that hormone has to, before another cell knows that it's there, what does that other cell have to have? A receptor, so the hormone has to bind to receptor, and that's going to change some things inside the cell. So it takes a long time, in a relative sense, for a hormone to send information from one part of your body to the other. It takes a long time. But the other thing is, right, it can have a long-lasting effect. So it can last for a long period of time. So nervous system is fast, but its duration is short. The endocrine system, okay, takes a long time to develop, but the action will persist for a long period of time. And that's kind of the scheme on how most things work. I don't know why that is, but it's some kind of principle that I've never really studied or learned much about. But in pharmacology, you will bump into some kinds of drugs. If they're fast acting, if they act fast, guess what their duration is? It's short, right? And if it takes a long time for a drug to have an effect, guess what their duration is? It's going to be long, right? That's almost a general principle that you can rely on. Okay, so let's talk about these things that will last for a long period of time, but it might take a little while for them to have an effect inside the body. All right, so here are a bunch of endocrine glands on this slide, and it has some of them, right? Like a gonad right here, testes, or an ovary in female. They secrete hormones like testosterone, right, or estrogen, progesterone, pancreas. Oh, let me get my cursor back before I go nuts. Okay. I see pancreas right here. What kind of hormones does a pancreas secrete? How about insulin? Probably you've heard of insulin. Comes from the pancreas, and there's also another one called glucagon. There might be some more, but we'll talk about insulin and glucagon in this class. Thyroid gland secretes. Yeah, thyroid hormone. And then we have some nervous tissue up over here. And the pituitary gland is part nervous tissue. It secretes hormones. We're going to look at some of those. The hypothalamus, which is a part of the brain, secretes hormones. All right, but since it's being secreted by a neuron, is it really appropriate to call these hormones that the hypothalamus secretes because they're secreted by a neuron? You would actually want to think of them as a neurohormone, right? But nonetheless, okay, these neurohormones that chemical secreted by a neuron has to enter the circulatory system and it's delivered by the blood. All right, so let's talk about what a hormone is. I don't think I have a slide on what a hormone is. All right, so a hormone is a substance that is produced by some kind of tissue, and it's a gland. So it's going to secrete that product outside the cell. And there are two major kinds of glands, depending on where that product ends up. All right, so what kind of gland secretes a product that goes into a duct, like a salivary gland secretes saliva into a duct and then the duct empties into your mouth? What kind of gland is that? That's what we call an exocrine gland. That's an exocrine gland. If there's a gland, okay, for instance, like the thyroid gland, it's going to secrete a product, and it's going to be absorbed by a capillary, and then once it's absorbed by a capillary, where does it go? All over the body. Not just one place, but all over the body. And can it have an effect all over the body? And the answer is no, because what does a tissue have to have in order to be able to recognize that hormone that's floating around in your body? It's got to have a receptor, right? All right, so that's a little bit better definition of what a hormone is. It is a chemical secreted by an endocrine gland that is picked up by the circulatory system, where it travels to a distant location, right? And it binds to a receptor, which means then it's a target tissue if it has a receptor, and that changes the physiology of the cell. So you got to have all those components, right, in order to understand if it's an endocrine system or not, whether it's a hormone or endocrine gland or whatever. And so it takes longer to develop, but it also lasts a longer period of time. So we see thyroid, hypothalamus. There are some other endocrine glands that you're going to be familiar with in this class, like the heart. Is the heart an endocrine gland? Okay. Maybe if you studied a little bit of some physiology, we'd have to say yes, because it secretes hormones that work on the kidney that help regulate blood pressure, which is going to be pretty interesting. And there's many other kinds of organs, right, that secrete hormones, just like the way we said, that you wouldn't necessarily think. Ah, kidneys right here. Right? Is the kidney an endocrine gland? Well, you know what? It's on this slide right here, and you know it does. It secretes something into the blood. It helps regulate red blood cell production, a hormone. So there are a lot of different kinds of endocrine glands in your body. We're going to learn about some of these. Here is a table that shows you what some of these endocrine glands are. Oh, here's heart right here. It secretes atrial natriuretic hormone. Natri right here represents sodium, right? Natrium is sodium. And it comes from the atria. And what does a uretic do? It increases urine volume, right? So it's going to have an effect on the kidney. It promotes excretion of sodium in the urine, natriuretic hormone. Don't want to talk too much about this. But when you secrete sodium, you also lose a lot of water. And what happens to your blood pressure when you're dehydrated, when you lose fluid from your body? You decrease. Yeah, blood pressure decreases. So it's one way to help regulate blood pressure. And if somebody needs to have their blood pressure increased, what's one way of doing that? Is to make sure they have plenty of fluids. Their blood volume will increase and so will their pressure. I think you're kind of familiar with that, because what's the first line of treatment for somebody that has hypertension? What's hypertension? Hypertension is elevated blood pressure, and of course that's very damaging, hurts your retina, kidneys, brain, heart. All right, so to reduce that, to reduce blood pressure, one of the first treatments is a diuretic. You lose volume from your body that decreases blood pressure. Okay, so you'll be learning some really nice physiology here in the near future. So I think you want to look over this table a little bit. Some of these things I mentioned already, like the pancreas secretes insulin and glucagon, and there are two of them. So what do you think the mode of action, or how would you describe the relationship between insulin and glucagon if there are two of them? It kind of reminds me of the biceps and triceps. Kind of reminds me of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Yeah, they are antagonistic to each other, right? And is that a good thing? Yeah, absolutely, because then you have precise control and balance over, what are we trying to regulate right here? Glucose concentration in the blood. Okay, so you might want to refer to this table now and then just to see where all of these different hormones fit in. Okay, hormones have different chemical classifications. Some are hydrophilic, some are hydrophobic. Amine hormones, what's an amine hormone? Amine means that it has... has nitrogen groups on it, right? And some amino acids have nitrogen, well, all amino acids, right? Because that's in the name, amino, but they have additional amino groups on them, right? Tyrosine and tryptophan, these are aromatic. That means they have fancy ring structures. We can't make these. We have to have these in our diet. But these are precursors for norepinephrine, epinephrine, thyroxine, and melatonin. We haven't talked about thyroxine until this chapter. There's some polypeptide hormones where there are just chains of amino acids joined together, right? So a polypeptide is what? Just a short protein, but it's still a protein. Antidiuretic hormone, growth hormone. Insulin is a protein, right? Oxytocin, glucagon, and all these other ones. What is ADH? Anybody know what ADH stands for? It stands for antidiuretic hormone. Okay, what does a diuretic do? If you take a diuretic, what does it do? Yeah, it makes you pee, right? It produces a lot of urine, right? And an antidiuretic does what? Keeps you from excreting a lot of water, so you maintain that water inside your body. That will help increase your blood pressure. So antidiuretic hormone, right, is one of the reasons why it's there is when you start to run low on water, is to conserve water, like when you're dehydrated. Some are glycoproteins, some are proteins like we saw in this case, but what does this glyco mean? What does glucose mean? Sugar. So here's a protein that's been modified by, it's been conjugated, or it's been added to a sugar molecule, right? LH, FSH, TSH are glycoproteins. What organelle does that? You should know. What modifies and packages? Golgi body, organelle, Golgi body, right inside the cell. And then here are some steroids. And steroids are pretty much in a class by themselves, separated from amines, peptides, and glycoproteins. Why is that? What makes steroids different than all the other ones that we talked about so far? They're lipid molecules, right? So all of these that we talked about previously are polar, they're hydrophilic. Steroids, on the other hand, are nonpolar, so they are hydrophobic, right? Which means that how can a steroid move through a cell membrane if it is nonpolar? The answer is yes, it can, because what is a membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer. Since it's a lipid, other lipids can dissolve across it. So you will see that steroid hormones can actually enter cells. The rest of these are hydrophilic, which means they can't enter a cell. So where are the receptors for these? If these hormones can't enter the cell, where are the receptors? They're outside the surface of the cell membrane. Where are the receptors for steroid hormones? They can be inside the cell because they can diffuse inside. So knowing some physical chemistry is really important. Question? Tyrosine, it's more nonpolar. It can diffuse through tyrosine. It's one of those more organic kinds of amino acids. Okay. So steroids, some examples of steroids would be testosterone, right? Estradiol, progesterone. Here's progesterone up over here. Notice that all of these, cortisol that comes from the adrenal cortex. These are all important hormones. They are all related to each other, right? Because I had you memorize this particular shape for the very first test. So these are all steroids. And where do you get all of these hormones from? What precursor molecule? You get all these hormones, progesterone, testosterone, estrogen, from cholesterol, when cholesterol is modified. So is cholesterol a good thing or bad thing to have in your body? Good thing? Exactly right, as long as you don't have too much, because it can produce cardiovascular disease, right? So, yeah. Yeah, if you make too much, if your body makes too much, or there's too much in your diet, then there are cardiovascular consequences to that. Okay, so that's all that this slide represents. Thyroid hormones, okay, are lipids, and they can diffuse into target cells. Two major thyroid hormones, if we look at these two molecules right here, you might notice one little difference. Carboxyl group is the same, amino group is the same, still this ethylene group over here. The rings are the same, but what is different? It has to do with this element here, and you had to memorize this for the first test. That is iodine. Yeah. So here is a thyroxine. It has four iodines, so sometimes we just call that T4, and T4 stands for tetraiodothreonine. And no one has time to say tetraiodothreonine, so we just say T4. What about this bottom one down over here? That it only has three, right? And that is triiodothreonine, or T3. And T3 is the active form of the hormone inside cells, right? But the form, most of the thyroxine that is produced by the thyroid gland is this T4 variety. It's transported a little bit more easily in the blood, and then it's converted into the active hormone once it enters a cell. And since this is a hydrophobic molecule, since it's a nonpolar molecule, it can enter cells. It can diffuse through the cell membrane. So the receptors for these things are inside the cell. All right, so I think we talked about this. Common aspects of neuroendocrine regulation. All right, both nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. Difference is in transport. All right, the neurotransmitters move by diffusion across the synaptic cleft, which is a very short distance. Hormones are transported by the blood over long distances. Some molecules, right, or chemicals can be used as hormones or neurotransmitters. So then we'd want to consider that thing a neurotransmitter, for instance. The targets for neurotransmitters and hormones, in order for them to have an effect on a tissue, what does that tissue have to have? It has to have a receptor, right? And you know how receptors work. What's the first thing that we, as a matter of fact, we talked about it in terms of rhodopsin? What does that receptor exhibit? It exhibits specificity, right? Because it has something that's like an active site. This hormone, if it changes shape a little bit, might not bind to the receptor. So there's a high degree of specificity. And there should be a way to rapidly inactivate both. Which one is inactivated more quickly, a neurotransmitter or a hormone? Neurotransmitter. Yeah, that's why its duration of action is short. Hormone duration of action is longer. It takes longer to inactivate. So this is a little bit misleading. There's almost no way to rapidly inactivate a hormone like there is a neurotransmitter. Okay, and just like a number of systems that we looked at, some hormones, if you have two hormones and if they work together to produce an effect, we say they're synergists. If there are two hormones that counteract each other, they're antagonists. A good example of antagonist pair would be insulin and glucagon. Some hormones have a permissive effect, which means that the second hormone can only have an effect if the first one is available. Okay, and if the first one isn't available, then the second one will have no effect on a target tissue whatsoever. We call that a permissive effect. Oh, here's that specificity, right? Mechanisms of hormone action, because it has to bind to receptor, right? It shows specificity, high affinity, low capacity for a hormone. Lipophilic hormones have receptors in the cytoplasm because they can diffuse through the cell membrane. And hydrophilic molecules have receptors on the cell membrane because they can't get into the cell. If it is a lipophilic hormone, which means it can get into the cell, most of the time they work by becoming transcription factors. What is transcription? That's previously in this class. What's transcription? It is. Okay, it's the first part of a two-part thing. What's that two-part thing that I'm thinking of? Transcription is the first part of?
Translation.
Okay, translation is the second part, but if you had transcription followed by translation, what is that whole process called? That's called protein synthesis. Protein synthesis, right? Okay, so some of these hormones act as transcription factors, which means that they can signal the production to start producing a particular hormone inside the cell, right? And then protein inside the cell, and then that protein will change, of course, the physiology of that cell somehow. And since they affect DNA, since lipid hormones can affect transcription, we call that the genomic action, right? And look how long that takes, probably a minimum of 30 minutes. To actually have a protein build up inside the cell as a result of a steroid hormone binding to a receptor. All right, so what is a genome? Anybody know? Everybody knows what a genome is. The genome is what? Just a collection of all genes that you find in a cell. Right? And that's just all the genes. And a gene is a segment of DNA that is responsible for making a protein. So a genome is all of those segments of DNA that are responsible for making different kinds of proteins in your body. And so steroid hormones have a genomic action because they're able to make or signal the production of certain kinds of hormones. Receptors for water-soluble on the surface of the target cell, because these hormones can't get inside the cell. And they work through second messengers. Right. What's a nice transduction scheme that can produce a second messenger? What kind of receptor are you familiar with that can have a second messenger appear inside the cell? We actually looked at it, all right, in the vision part. It's a G protein coupled receptor. G protein coupled receptor. Okay. And it just so happens that there are some steroid hormones that are not transcription factors. They don't cause the production of proteins inside the cell. We just call that the non-genomic action of those hormones, but they still can enter the cell. All right, let's take a look at this cell. Here we got different components here, or compartments. Here we have blood, probably shaded red. I see a nice cell membrane. I see cytoplasm. And then I see the nucleus. What do we have inside the nucleus? Genetic material, right? It's behind that protective membrane, like DNA. And remember, DNA contains information on how to make all the proteins in your body and when to make those proteins. And since it knows when and how to make a protein, it knows how to make those structures, what does the nucleus then know how to do if it knows how to make all those proteins, those specific structures? It also controls the function of a cell, right? If it controls the structures inside the cell, it controls the function. So that's the importance of that nucleus. So H stands for hormone, and this is going to be a lipid hormone. Does lipid dissolve in blood? Does the lipid substance dissolve in blood? No, it doesn't, right? Because it is hydrophobic. So a steroid hormone, for instance, has to have a carrier protein, some kind of carrier protein that it binds to that allows it to dissolve in a watery environment. So here's that carrier protein, and there's always going to be an equilibrium established between a hormone that is free in the plasma and that's contained on the carrier molecule. Most is on the carrier molecule, but it hops on and off, and after it hops off, guess what it likes to do? Hop back on. But there's a certain period of time that it hops off. And when it hops off, it can move by diffusion, right, from high concentration to low. And it's low concentration inside the cell, high concentration in the blood. So what is this lipid, lipophilic hormone, what does it do if there's low concentration inside the cell? What goes from high to low? Just diffusion, right? And so the hormone wants to diffuse inside the cell, but can it? Can it get across the cell membrane? A lipid hormone can diffuse across the membrane because the membrane is what? A phospholipid. So it can diffuse inside the cell, right? So the receptors for this lipophilic hormone are not on the cell surface, they're inside the cell, and I do see them inside the cell. Here is a receptor protein. When it binds the hormone, it will translocate into the nucleus, it will bind to a segment of DNA, and when it binds right here, it's going to cause transcription of this segment of DNA. So this is a gene, right? So it activates that gene, and what's the product of transcription? It is RNA. RNA then leaves the nucleus, and remember, RNA then is used as a template or as some kind of code to make a protein. And then the second step of protein synthesis happens in the cytosol or cytoplasm. Okay, what's that step called? So going from DNA to RNA is transcription. Going from RNA to protein is translation. Remember, they're different languages. Yeah, so that's translation. Where does translation take place inside the cell? Cytoplasm or endoplasmic reticulum, if the endoplasmic reticulum has what? And if the cytosol has what? It's got to have a special little organelle called a ribosome, right? Ribosome. Okay, so this messenger RNA has to interact with the ribosome before translation can take place. And when these proteins are produced, it's going to produce then the response to this signaling compound right here. Right, so it's going to change some structures inside the cell, changing the physiology of this cell. All right, so lipophilic hormones are transcription factors. Right, when they bind to their receptors inside the cell that activate transcription, and you know that that is the first step in protein synthesis. Okay. Well, a little bit more complicated, but not too complicated. Here's that same hormone. Okay. Here is that receptor that we said was inside the cell. Well, there are two parts to this receptor. There is a ligand binding domain, which will bind the hormone, but it has the right shape to bind the hormone, which probably is not the right shape to bind to DNA. Right, because the shape of a hormone is a lot different than DNA. So this receptor then also has to have a domain that has the right shape to bind DNA. So this receptor protein for steroid hormone has a ligand binding domain and a DNA binding domain. And the DNA binding domain, right, has the right shape to bind to DNA only when the hormone is bound to this ligand binding domain, because it changes the shape, right? And so here are some places where a receptor that has a ligand bound to it can actually bind, right? So when a hormone binds to the receptor, the DNA binding domain has the right shape, it can bind to DNA, and that can activate transcription. It will turn this gene on, right? It will allow transcription of this gene. But when you look at this site for binding of that receptor, what do you see? Do you see just one? How many sites do you see right here? I see one on the left and one on the right. There are actually two sites. This is what we call a hormone response unit. So there are two half sites. So guess what has to happen before transcription can take place? Both of these sites right here have to be bound with that appropriate signal, which is what? That receptor protein that has a hormone here. So that's what I see in this last case. So in this case, we need two hormones bound to this receptor, and they bind to the hormone response element that will then start transcription. Now this hormone here is just a H, right? What about this hormone over here? What is it? It's an H. Is this a capital H on the left? And what about on the right? It's a H. What about the background color? Is there a difference between the left and the right? No, they're the same. And the letter is the same, and they're both capitals. So what's the difference between this hormone and this hormone over here? There's no difference in color, there's no difference in shape, right? There's no difference between them. In this particular case, right, then this is what we call dimerization. Dimer just means two. But in this case, because it's the exact same hormone, exact same receptor, we call this a homodimer, or homodimerization. So sometimes transcription can be initiated, right, with just two of the same subunits. That's not always the case, right? If it's two of the same, then we call that homodimerization. Homo meaning what? The same. Okay. All right, and here is that hormone response element. Ah, dimerization, in this case, homodimerization. Okay. The thyroid gland secretes mostly T4, which is thyroxine, a little bit of T3, and T4 is bound to a carrier protein because T4 is more lipid than polar. Right? And so that carrier protein is what we call thyroid binding globulin. So globulins are chemicals in the blood that can transport lipid molecules around in your body. And some of that T4 jumps off the TBG, and when it does, it can move by diffusion into the cell. And when T4 enters the cell, it's converted to T3. T3 is the active form, which can bind to a receptor protein, right? And this particular one is located in the nucleus. So this thyroid hormone, what is a transcription factor, can regulate protein synthesis inside cells if they have a receptor for it. All right, so let's look at this slide. Same kind of thing. I see the hormone response element down over here, right? It has two half sites, so it's going to have two receptors bound to this area. So here is a receptor for retinoic acid. Here is a receptor for what's triiodothreonine. That is T3, that's the signal from what gland? The thyroid gland, right? So that's a thyroid hormone. Right? It's converted from T4 inside the cell. So when these are bound, right, then these two receptors can bind to the hormone response element. And on one side, we have the retinoic acid. On the other side, we have T3 binding. So that's a step of dimerization. But what kind of dimerization is this? Is this homodimerization?
No,
they're different, right? So this would be an example of heterodimerization, which also kind of explains sometimes why a molecule like retinoic acid will have a permissive effect, right, on a hormone, because this T3 can't have an effect, can't produce this protein, can't be a transcription factor unless there is some retinoic acid inside the cytoplasm as well. So there are two things that have to come align just perfectly in order to transcribe this particular gene, okay? And so that is heterodimerization. All right, water-soluble hormones can't get inside the cell, so their receptors have to be outside the cell on the cell membrane. And since that signaling compound can't enter the cell, what happens inside, what's a nice scheme that you're aware of that can take a signal that's outside, that's stuck outside the cell, and create a signal that's inside the cell that will change the physiology inside the cell? A nice second messenger, right? What is always outside the cell? First messenger. What's always inside the cell? Second messenger. They can't go across the cell membrane. Okay, and we looked at some of these. What is one of your favorite second messenger systems? Okay, cyclic GMP, that is triggered by a G-protein-coupled receptor. Right, so that G-protein-coupled receptor is hugely important in our bodies. Okay, here's an example. This might have been an exam figure even. All right, so here's a hormone binding to the receptor. Right, so here's a receptor. Was this on the test? Yeah, okay, I don't even have to go over. Well, here's that receptor, right, and it's coupled to a G-protein. When the hormone binds, this activates the G-protein, causes dissociation of the subunits. When the alpha bumps into adenylate cyclase, and what does that do? What does adenylate cyclase do? That's an important enzyme to know. It creates, takes ATP, makes cyclic AMP out of it. Okay, and then that cyclic AMP can interact with various proteins inside the cell, maybe exciting or inhibiting or activating or inactivating various kinds of enzymes, which means then it will speed up or decrease the rate of some chemical reactions. Right, so in this particular case, we have a protein kinase. What does that do? What does a kinase do? Adds a phosphate to something, changing its shape and therefore what its function is. And this protein kinase has an inhibitory subunit. When cyclic AMP binds to it, it rips the inhibitory subunit off, and we see that over here. And now we have an active protein kinase. And it's going to run around and phosphorylate numbers of things, of different kinds of things inside the cell, either activating or inactivating them. So what's the first messenger?
Receptor.
Hormone. What's the second messenger? The second messenger is cyclic AMP. What produces cyclic AMP? Okay, cyclic AMP comes from ATP. So ATP gets used up when cyclic AMP builds up, right? One disappears while the other one appears. Second messenger appears when ATP goes away. All right, but there's something in this reaction that does not go away. What is that? So how is cyclic AMP made? It's made by activating this enzyme, adenylate cyclase, right? So that was the question I was trying to ask you, and that is, what happens to adenylate cyclase after it produces a cyclic AMP out of an ATP? Does it get used up? What about an enzyme? Does an enzyme get used up when it catalyzes a reaction? No, it doesn't. So what can it do again? It can produce another cyclic AMP and another and another and another until it becomes deactivated when this alpha subunit comes off. All right. So here we had how many hormones? One. How many cyclic AMPs? Many. Much more than one. I don't want to say one, two, thousands, 10,000 or whatever. So what do we call this first step of going from one molecule to many? That is a step of amplification, right? So one simple hormone can produce many, many second messengers inside the cell, which then activates another enzyme, this kinase, and after this kinase, right, does its job, does it become inactivated? Does the protein kinase become inactivated? What can you tell me about an enzyme? Does it get used up?
No.
It doesn't get used up. So this protein kinase doesn't phosphorylate one molecule, it can phosphorylate one, and then another, then another, then another. All right, so what do we call this step right here? Okay, so you're going to have now millions of these activated enzymes. All right, and you started with one hormone. Here is another level of amplification, right? So you have coupled enzyme systems, right? Each one has a level of amplification, and what do we call that when you have a number of steps and they all amplify? That is what we call a cascade mechanism, right? So on this slide, you see a nice cascade mechanism. All right, and there you see that nice cell membrane. So what kind of hormone is this? Take a look at this membrane here. What kind of hormone does that look like? Is that a lipophilic or lipophobic? Or is it a hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It is a hydrophilic molecule, which means that it can't move across the cell membrane because the inside of the membrane is the lipid part of it, right? It's because it's a phospholipid bilayer. So only lipid kinds of substances or nonpolar substances can enter the cell. That's why this hormone has to act through a second messenger system in order to change the physiology inside the cell. Okay. Time to go. So we'll start with this slide, but look at here. Here's an old friend, phosphodiesterase. What does phosphodiesterase do? Ooh, look that up. Look that up if you don't know. Phosphodiesterase. For next time. Office hours on Thursday are 8:30 to 11. Sometimes I'm on the third floor, sometimes I'm on the second floor. And the directions are on my office door where I be. Okay. 8:30 to 11 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I did it already. It's in Blackboard.